Hi, everybody. I'm Greg. Thanks for coming, and thanks to the organizers for having me here. I'm very excited to talk about something completely new. You guys will be the first people to see what this is about, so I hope you find it interesting. The first author is a student in our group, Rob Bruckelman. He's also here, so hopefully you get a chance to talk to him if you're interested in the work. So I'm going to start with a very general problem that maybe some of you have heard of. It goes by different names. The basic idea is that you'd have some sort of very complex input or observations, and you want to compress it into some smaller space, and you'd like to do that in a way that so that the compressed representation is still optimal for some task t, something that you'd like to do. So it's a optimal compression type of problem, lossy compression. So that sounds like a pretty nice general idea. And this was originally in information theory. This is called rate distortion, and it goes back to Shannon. In machine learning, it has a different name as the information bottleneck, but it's the same general idea. What is the optimal trade-off between compression and performing some task for some sort of information processing system? So that's cool. One mathematical formulation of that, just to make it more precise, would be to say something like this. You'd say, we're really trying to solve some sort of optimization problem, and what we're saying is that we would like to compress the input x into this space z, so minimize this mutual information as much as possible, while minimizing some notion of distortion, like some measure of how well we can use z to perform a task t. So this is the general one way of writing this general trade-off, and the thing that we're optimizing is really this noisy channel, q of z given x. So that encompasses a lot of problems. If we put in different things for distortion, we can get a lot of different types of problems here. But the part I want to focus on is this mutual information over here. When can we get this? When can we characterize the mutual information between z and x? It's actually kind of difficult, usually. So there's some toy cases where we can do this. So if you have low-dimensional categorical variables in the original information bottleneck work, this is what they focus on. It's a cool case because then you can really optimize over all possible noisy channels, q of z given x. So that's an interesting case. Another case is if you restrict your noisy channels to something simple like Gaussian noise, and if the inputs are also Gaussian, you can then also get kind of an exact characterization of this lossy compression problem. But we don't want to stick to these kind of simple cases. We'd like to do something more. The possibilities are not great, so you can rely on information estimators. And I've worked a lot on those, and there's tons of problems that can occur, especially if these are all high-dimensional. And you can rely on bounds. And I think bounds are the more typical way that people approach this, upper bounds on mutual information. And we'll talk about that approach, too. So I'll start with just like a very typical type of bound that you would see for doing this compression problem, a variational mean field-style bound. And then we'll talk about whether it's possible that we could design a more flexible type of noise channel that also allows us to do get an exact characterization of how much compression we have, and this equinoise channel. So once we have we can exactly characterize the noise, that's very nice because now we can do these kind of these rate distortion problems where we can specify the rate exactly. So we'll talk about different applications. Our group works a lot on latent factor models, so the application we ended up working on first is these variational autoencoders. It's an unsupervised problem. I don't think most people think about it as a lossy compression problem, but I'll show you it really is very natural and maybe more natural to think of it like a lossy compression problem. So I'll show you why that problem is really lossy compression, and then we'll use the equinoise to get a tighter bound on compression in that case. And we'll show you some results. And to get this discussion going at the end, I'll talk about it. So we've heard a whole bunch of things about generalization. Everyone wants to solve this problem. So I'll talk about a little bit of a controversy that I know some of the people here are interested in, which is about whether compression has anything to do with generalization. I won't answer that question, but I'll at least introduce that to you. And you know, the relevance to this talk is that, hey, one part of testing whether generalization and compression are related is to actually be able to do the compression. And that part has actually been very hard, and some of the analysis that's looked at this has actually had problems on that front. So maybe with better compression, more exact characterization of the compression, we can do better there. So let's start with an example where we derive a bound on the compression rate using kind of standard tools. And you can see what that looks like, and then we'll see how we can hopefully do better. Oh. Okay, so first of all, we're going to have all these probability densities. We use things like Q and P for that. You'll see that I'm using Q from the outset. The reason, usually we'd use P and then Q for a variational distribution. I'm starting with Q because in machine learning, there's sort of a convention which has it backwards. So sorry for the confusion. That's why we're sticking with the Q so that we match with some other conventions later on. So Q is a probability distribution. I use this notation about from information theory that a random variable is a capital letter, and it takes values, which are these bold lowercase vectors. So this is a great notation because sometimes it helps us distinguish the role of random variables from the actual values that they take. But it's usually too cumbersome, so almost all the time we're just going to shorten it like this. So I'm just trying to make sure that the notation is making sense, and feel free to stop me if something looks dicey, because I love to shorten notation beyond the point of usefulness. So we have this noisy channel. So the input is Q of X, and the noisy channel is characterized by this distribution Q of Z given X. Okay, so the thing that we're interested in is mutual information. Now you'll get another dump of new notation. We can write mutual information in a bunch of different ways. Here's a few different ways. So it's mutual information between Z and X. You can write it in terms of entropy. So there's a differential entropy in this case. H of Z, some people say that's the uncertainty in Z, and this is telling us how much our uncertainty about Z is reduced by knowing about X. So that's, oh, sorry, yes. Ha.
Yeah, so for this rate distortion formulation to really make sense, you need a bunch of assumptions about your source and your distortion metrics. For instance, the source must be ergodic, and the distortion metric must be, I don't know, separable or something like that. Are you assuming all the things here? Because here you seem to be completely general, and in a general setting, you know, this doesn't need to have any meaning, really.
So at the moment, we're really just, I mean, so we're going to apply to the rate distortion setting later. This is really just, here's a lossy channel, what's the mutual information? So at this point, we're not really doing
But anything. Mutual information doesn't need to mean anything in general. I mean, it's not guaranteed that it has any operational meaning.
So mutual information usually, you'd say it has some meaning that can be made operational in terms of the number of bits it would take under certain circumstances.
Yeah, for that you need assumptions on the channel.
Right. Yeah, and there would be
in general, it doesn't correspond to a number.
So, I mean, maybe, So, I mean, I think we're kind of piggybacking on this operational meaning without actually tying it concretely. It might be an interesting thing to do later to say, okay, so we have this characterization of mutual information. What would it take to give it this operational meaning in terms of bits in a physical channel? We're not going to do that, though. Yeah. And maybe from that point of view, you'd say, oh, maybe there's other information measures that would be interesting. Actually, it would be kind of interesting to think whether this scheme we're going to introduce would generalize to other information measures, which might correspond to other physical operational signals. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I was in the middle of deriving kind of a bound on mutual information that people often use. We start with this definition in terms of, I keep hitting these buttons with the side of my finger, so I'm forgetting where I'm at. So I forgot to go through this notation part. So I said these are different ways to write mutual information. This is KL divergence. This is another way to look at it, a kind of faux distance between probability distributions. But the most direct way is to just write it in terms of expected log probabilities. That's the easiest. But I wanted to introduce all these notations so that we can shorthand things later on. The big problem that shows up here is really this Q of Z. Let's zoom in on what Q of Z is and see why it's so problematic. It's this very high-dimensional integral in principle. Usually, if we're thinking of X as like the inputs to our channel, it's going to be something complex, some crazy data set. We usually have samples from it. We probably won't have an analytic expression for this. So there's really no hope that we're going to get a Q of Z that we can work with analytically. So that's part of the problem. So what we might do instead is this kind of variational bound. So we'll start with mutual information on the top line, and we're going to introduce what is now going to be a variational approximation, P of Z. So we're going to multiply by 1, P of Z over P of Z here. And then we're going to rearrange, and that's how we get this KL divergence term. So we break it up into these two pieces, and you can see that this KL divergence is basically telling us what is the quality of this variational approximation, what's the distance between Q and P. We know that KL divergences are non-negative, so if we throw away this non-negative term, that leaves us with an upper bound for mutual information, which has this form. So this is a one way to upper bound mutual information. And usually, the reason we did this was because we wanted something very simple to work with. So usually we'll impose on top of that some sort of mean field approximation. So P of Z will be factorized in some way. And these will be something that we can parametrize with some simple class of probability distributions, usually Gaussians. So this is just an example of a way to get kind of a variational upper bound for the rate. Okay, so let's show an example of what that might look like. Again, this is also partially to fix notation in your mind, so when we start doing more complicated things, you'll be on the right track. So one way, we have two ways that we can represent this noisy channel. One is, I said, in terms of these probability distributions, Q of Z given X. So if we have a Gaussian channel, we're just saying that this is a Gaussian, which the Gaussian part came out. That should be a normal centered at Gaussian at Xi with variance Si squared. But the other way to represent that is just to say it's an additive channel, Zi equals Xi plus S epsilon, where epsilon is a standard normal Gaussian noise. So this is our noisy channel, and we'd say, given this, someone handed us to this as our noisy channel, what is the mutual information between Z and X? Well, it could be kind of hard to figure that out because the distribution of X could be complicated, so we're going to use that type of mean field bound that we showed on the previous slide. And if you did that, you'd say, okay, first we have to find a variational approximation P of Z, which is optimal. You could optimize it and you'd get something that looks like this. And that would lead you to a final bound, which would be something like this, that the mutual information between Z and X for this Gaussian noise channel is upper bounded with an expression that looks like this. It's log 1 plus, and this is something that looks like a signal-to-noise ratio. So that has kind of an intuitive term. This is really the exact expression in the case where the inputs are Gaussian, and wow, this thing really is finicky. Let's see where we... this would be exact in the case that the inputs were Gaussian and they were all independent from each other and so forth. Then we could get equality here. So this Gaussian bound, great for Gaussians, but might not be very good in other cases where we're trying to compress a complex distribution. So the question is whether we could try to do something better than this. And that's what we're going to look at next. All right. So the idea is to instead of using simple Gaussian noise, maybe we can choose a noise model which is flexible, but also makes it easier for us to characterize this rate. So that's what we're gonna try to get. This calling it echo noise is a kind of a figurative language. It's trying to evoke the idea that the noise should somehow resemble the signal. That sounds maybe kind of strange. Motivation for doing that, if you've ever studied the Gaussian noise channel, if you have correlated noise in the Gaussian channel and you say what is the optimal way to have to arrange the signal for optimal information transmission, you find out that the answer is that the signal should also be correlated, and it should be correlated in the same basis as the noise. So there's a sense where we have some sort of matching between the noise model and the signal. So that's just kind of a weak intuition that for optimal information transmission, it might make sense to have some sort of matching going on here. So that's just a motivation, but really the reason we want these distributions to look similar is because we use this to derive our expression for mutual information. So let's try it out, and I'm going to start with like a wrong way to do it, and then we'll make it a little more complicated. So again, we have this sort of additive noise model. So z is some function of x, and we add some noise. So epsilon is a random variable. S is just a scalar. And we say, OK, well, one thing we could do is make epsilon be Gaussian. We saw what happens in that case. If we really want to express this intuition that the noise should somehow resemble the signal, one way that we could do that would be as a try. What if we just let epsilon, what if we took an independent sample of from our input distribution, Q of x, and we let epsilon be f of x? So now it's just an independent draw from basically the same distribution that we're drawing the signal from. So if you did that, you might say, you could look at what the distributions for epsilon and the distribution for z are. Epsilon has some distribution, which is whatever the distribution over f of x is. But if you compare it to z, where we plug in for epsilon this expression, z looks something like this, f of x plus s fx prime. This is really a convolution between the probability distribution over f of x and a scaled version of that probability distribution. So in general, even though we tried to get epsilon to look more like the output signal z, we failed. These two distributions are not going to be the same in general. But that, I hope, is pointing you in the right direction that we'd like to do something a little bit fancier with constructing the noise epsilon so that we get the distribution between the noise and the signal to match. Okay, so now we're going to do the main trick to see how we can do that. So again, we have this additive noise channel. We want to choose epsilon in a way that makes the distribution of z and epsilon identical. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to take a whole bunch of IID draws from Q of x, which is the input distribution, and we're going to add them together in this attenuated way, in this infinite sum. We have f of x plus s times f of x plus s squared times f of x. So it's this infinite series of sort of attenuated draws from our input distribution. So that looks pretty weird. Why would we do that? The reason is if we plug epsilon back up into this expression on top, let's see how that looks. Now we'll get that z is f of x plus s times epsilon, which is drawn constructed from all of these IID samples drawn from x. And if you multiply this out, you'd get f plus s times f plus s squared times f plus s cubed times f. Note that these indices are just labeling the IID samples from our input distribution, Q of x. So they're totally arbitrary. We could relabel them. And what we'd see is that z and epsilon are really exactly the same, or at least in distribution, they're the same, if I could do this. So that is the property that we were trying to get, so that we can get our exact characterization of mutual information, that epsilon, the noise, and the output signal z are the same in distribution. Okay, so that's the main trick. Let me just show you quickly. This is, I kind of wrote this all for scalars. You can do this in a much more general way. So I'll just show you in this slide. So the z's and f and epsilon could all be vectors. That attenuation factor s, in general, that could be a matrix. And additionally, we could let that noise, that kind of attenuation on the noise, be sample dependent. So at every point x, we could apply a different scaling matrix on the noise. So even if we define the noisy channel in this way, we can still do the same kind of trick where we write epsilon is this infinite series of IID samples. You can make it more compact like this, and you'll still get the same result, that the distribution of epsilon should be the same as the distribution of z. Okay. So to move away from the long equations, I wanted to give a concrete example so you can visualize what it means to construct noise in this way. So we're going to take a specific non-Gaussian distribution. Here's the distribution, Q of x. It's a two-dimensional distribution. We're going to draw samples uniformly from this shape. And that's going to be our example of a non-Gaussian distribution. So so that's what inputs look like. They're going to look like draws from this. what does it mean to construct echo noise in the way that we described? One way to visualize it is like this. So I said, well, we're going to construct the noise, we're going to take IID samples from the data, XIs like this, and we're going to add this attenuation factor, which is S equals 1/2 in this case. So that's how we would draw samples from the epsilon distribution. And another way to think of that would be that what we're really doing is a convolution, an infinite series of convolutions, where we're convolving the original data distribution with a scaled version of itself, with a smaller scaled version, with a smaller scaled version, et cetera. And if you were to carry that out in this case, you could get some sort of distribution that looks like this. So this is like what the distribution of the noise would look like. So we started with Q of X. We want to construct a noise distribution with a special property. It's constructed in this way. This is the distribution. And I said what's most important is that the distribution of epsilon looks like the distribution of Z. So let's see how that looks. How do we construct Z? That is the noisy channel. We take some X and we add noise from this epsilon distribution. So we're really convolving our original probability distribution with a scaled version of the epsilon distribution, which looks like this. And the result is this probability distribution. So hopefully visually you can see why these two things are exactly the same, right? Because this infinite series of convolutions here converges to this. So these two things are going to be the same. Okay, so that's kind of a long-winded way. I was hoping to develop a little intuition about why it is that the noise in this channel is exactly the same as the distribution of the outputs of this channel. A quick caveat or two. I said, well, this is maybe kind of a strange noise distribution compared to Gaussians. We know how to sample Gaussian noise. If we want to sample this noise, we need a bunch of IID samples from our data. Usually that's not a big deal. But formally, we need an infinite number of such samples, and that is a big deal. But you can see just from looking at this picture that you really wouldn't expect this is a series that can converge very quickly. So if we want to sample noise to within machine precision, for instance, we can usually cut off this sum after a finite number of terms, and that's what we'll do. For this convergence to work, though, I mean, obviously the series has to actually converge. So the S has to be small enough, or if we're doing the vector case, the spectral radius of that attenuation matrix has to be less than 1. How many terms do we really need to get this type of convergence? And this is going to be kind of a practical question when we try to implement this for some actual information processing system. If we have 1/2, it looks like that series converges very quickly, but actually you can imagine that if you're trying to have a higher noise by increasing that attenuation factor S, you can see this series is going to converge quite slowly, right? So that's kind of an interesting limit, because if we want to get high noise, which corresponds to a low mutual information, then we're going to need many terms in this series. So it's kind of a computational trade-off. The more compression you get, the more sampling that you need. I swear I'm not touching that button, and it just jumps around. All right. So anyway, that's just something to keep in mind. In general, it's not a problem. Like at the levels of compression that we're going to show in results, we usually just need a few hundred samples from this expression. Yeah.
If you're putting a lot of emphasis on these terms, but I mean, if you Fourier transform the thing and exponentiate it, an inverse Fourier transform, you resum the entire infinite tower.
So, yeah.
But I don't know how much you really care. I mean, that's part of what I'm missing in the motivation. You said in the Gaussian case, it's good to align them, and I can buy that. And then that was motivation for trying to make the noise and the things align. But, you know, physically, if I'm trying to do the Batman, I don't see why. It doesn't seem like really small bats are going to matter anymore. What is the precise statement, motivation, for if you're outside of the Gaussian case? Is there still some kind of statement that the noise and the data, you know, have this property is good?
So this first thing you said was about, let's do the Fourier series. And there's like a really nice, efficient way to write down this into the Fourier series. I guess I'm considering the case where usually we don't actually have this distribution of x to begin with. So if we did have it, there might be a nice analytic way using Fourier series to represent how it's transformed. So like this bat symbol has some mathematical expression, and we could do that. Usually we're actually imagining that we don't have an expression for it. We're just sampling. We only have samples, in which case this procedure is sort of an easy way to use those samples to generate our noise. I don't know if that answers your question, but we're really interested in actually constructing this out of samples. But there might be a nice way to represent it analytically too. Okay. So I talked all about this property, about how these distributions are the same, but that's not what we started with. What we started with is we wanted to get this mutual information between Z and X. And I claimed that this is a noisy channel where we can characterize that precisely. So H of Z we know something about now. H of Z is the same as H of epsilon, the entropy of the noise. We don't know the entropy of the noise either, so that seems like a very dubious step to have spent so much time on. But let's have a look next at what H of Z given X looks like, and then we're going to see how we can get at the mutual information. Okay. So this is kind of a general result. It doesn't have anything to do with echo noise. Just any type of noise channel that has this this additive structure Z equals F of X plus S of X times epsilon, where epsilon is the noise. We can look at, so what is H of Z given X, this entropy? We can expand Z. It's F of X plus S of X epsilon. And here we're kind of bringing in this distinction between random variables and values again. We can expand this the conditional entropy as saying it's really an expectation for each particular value of X. So we have this entropy of F of X plus S of X times epsilon. So within the expectation, we can view those things as constants. Epsilon is still a random variable, though. So we're going to use these properties of differential entropy. And one of the properties of differential entropy is this translation invariance. If we take the random variable epsilon and we translate it by some value, some constant F, the differential entropy is unchanged. So that's what gets us to the next line in this expression. We can just translate out all the F of X dependence. It doesn't matter. And now we have to worry about this S of X, this kind of scaling term in front of epsilon. And to get that, we use the scaling property of differential entropy. And the scaling property basically says, if you have some sort of distribution and you scale it by a factor S, the differential entropy is shifted by a constant, which is log S. And there's a vector version of this as well. And the vector version gives you a term like this one, log of the determinant of S of X. Okay, so for a kind of generic noisy channel of this form, we can figure out what H of Z given X is. And it looks like that. So now we're going to put this all together. H of Z given X is related to the entropy of the noise channel plus some term. For the echo channel in particular, we proved this result that H of Z is the same as H of epsilon. So if you add these two things together to get the mutual information, what you get is an expression like this. So by crafting our noise in a kind of special way, we get this nice exact expression for what the mutual information should be. So let me say one or two things about that, why this might be useful. S of X is really just a function that we choose at the beginning. We can parameterize it however we want. Maybe it's parameterized by some neural network. And once we set it, this works for any input distribution. There's no reference to the distribution except for this expectation, which really means that as long as we're sampling the noise from our input distribution, this expression for the mutual information will hold. So we can use this for Gaussians, we can use it for non-Gaussians, we can use it for whatever. Okay, so that's what we wanted to get at, was this very easy to control mutual information rate for our lossy compression problems. So there's one more thing I wanted to talk about. So besides making this mutual information very easy to control, I compared at the beginning this sort of variational bounds that you can derive. So in this example, for instance, you say, okay, if we want to get a compression level of 3 bits, all we have to do is set our function, our attenuation function S, to give us the right answer to set it at 3 bits. That's what gives us our echo noise. And OK, so this is a sort of example of what the noisy distribution looks like when we have 3 bits of mutual information. If we use that variational bound with Gaussian noise, we could also do something like that, where we would set the noise level, the signal-to-noise ratio, basically, so that we have an upper bound of 3 bits. But for a general non-Gaussian distribution, you can see that you're really losing a lot more information than you had intended by doing that. So just as kind of a visual example, that these variational bounds can be very loose, especially if the inputs are not Gaussian. OK, so now we have a noise channel where we can control the information rate exactly. So what are we going to use this for? There's a lot of things you might try. The thing that we started with were variational autoencoders. From our point of view, this is just another lossy compression problem. That's not the standard way of looking at it, so I'll kind of introduce why we look at it that way. And there's some nice discussion of this if you're interested in connections with statistical physics. OK, so in the variational autoencoder, you have an encoder and a decoder. So the traditional way of looking at this is from the generative modeling perspective, that we have a generative model P. So there's some prior P of Z, and then you generate data through this decoder P of X given Z. That's the generative model. And from that point of view, if you wanted to figure out what is the latent factor representation for a specific input X, it would seem like the optimal thing you could do is to estimate it with a true posterior P of Z given X. But that's generally a hard thing to calculate. So what they do instead is to introduce what, from that point of view, is the variational distribution Q of Z given X, which is supposed to approximate the posterior P of Z given X. OK, so that's the kind of traditional way of looking at it. So what are we going to train? What's the objective for training a model like this? We would like to make that generative model put high likelihood on the samples that we actually observe in our observations. So we want to make the data very likely under one of these generative models. So that's not very easy, because calculating P of X for this generative model also, you know, usually depends on this high dimensional integral. So we can't get at this directly. So instead, we're going to use a bound to get at the log likelihood. So let me show you that bound, and then we'll talk about how this connects to lossy compression. So here's a kind of one-line derivation of this type of bound. We start with the expectation of the log likelihood of data under the generative model P. And remember that Q of X is the actual data. Q of X is the data that's given to you. In the first line, we just subtract a non-negative quantity. And again, that non-negative quantity is just telling us what is the quality of the variational approximation Q of Z given X compared to the true posterior P of Z given X. And if you rearrange all the terms, you get the next line. And the next line, we can look at the two terms and say, well, this first term is really something like a cross entropy. It's telling us, given Z, how well can our generative model reconstruct the sample, the true data sample that was given to us. So this is like our distortion measure or reconstruction loss. This term is the one that we're interested in. So we've actually seen this expression already in the talk from a different point of view. When we were talking about what would be a kind of variational mean field way of upper bounding the mutual information, we said, oh, one way you could do that is to upper bound the mutual information between Z and X with this expression where P of Z is like a variational approximation. So from the generative modeling perspective, P of Z is, they sometimes call that the prior over the latent factors. It's something that you can specify. You can make it whatever you want. Looking at this inequality, it seems like the best choice that you could make would be if P of Z equals Q of Z, making this bound tight and making this lower bound on log likelihood as large as possible. So we're going to replace this term with a specific choice where P of Z equals Q of Z, and we know that that's the tightest choice that we can make. So if we want the best possible bound on log likelihood, that's what we should do. So after we've done this, our lower bound on log likelihood changes, and it looks like this. So now our lower bound on log likelihood looks like this first term, which I said was like a distortion or a reconstruction error, and the second term, which is a mutual information. So this is giving us our kind of rate distortion problem back again, that we'd like to get as big a bound as possible, we'd like to minimize mutual information while maximizing this other term. So that's the optimization problem that we're going to solve. Phi and theta are the parameters of our encoder and decoder models. This distortion or reconstruction loss is going to stay exactly the same as it has ever been for VAEs. And the only thing that we're going to do something different with is this compression term. Generally, you can add in a beta here if you wanted to explore the different trade-offs between compression and distortion. Okay, so that's the problem we're gonna study. To do this with equinoise, all that we do is write down our expression for mutual information in here. We have an analytic form for that. And when we do our reconstructions, we have to do that by first sampling noise according to this echo procedure. Okay. So let's look at how this looks for results. So one of the first things we can look at is negative log likelihood. So that's something we can compare between different models. Lower would be better. The first data set has to be MNIST, of course. Just to kind of set what your expectations should be. If the images were all completely static, we would have 784 bits would be the best you could do, which is 543 nats, which is our unit here. And if all the images were completely white, you could get down to zero. So the true optimal is whatever the entropy of the data is, and we don't know what that is generally. So I have a few methods that we compare here. VAE is kind of the standard one. This is a more recent variation of VAE that tries to make that variational approximation between P of Z and Q of Z as close as possible. So we thought that'd be an interesting one to compare. These flow is an autoregressive flow method. They're based on this kind of invertible transformations that take a distribution into something that's approximately Gaussian. So a little bit different idea here, but still has this kind of Gaussian flavor to it. So when we do this with the echo VAE, we do much, much better. So I should emphasize that there's a few reasons why this might be. Our bound is tighter. Our noise model is more general. We don't have to make any assumptions about Gaussianity or independence of latent factors. So this is just MNIST. Everybody knows MNIST is junk anyway. So we should do something harder. So let's look at a harder data set. Here's one of the other kind of popular new data sets, which are a little bit harder than MNIST. It's 50 different alphabets, and they have 20 handwritten digits. Handwritten examples of each of those. They don't look like real alphabets to me, but I guess I haven't been around enough. So on this, we do kind of similar, not quite as impressive as MNIST, but we also get much better log likelihood bounds here.
This is the original bound, your version where you replace the normal elbow.
That's right, yeah, so if you know the elbow. Right, so for these other methods, you're using the elbow, and I said there's this tighter version of the elbow where we let P of Z equals Q of Z. It's still a lower bound on log likelihood, but we are using a tighter one, which is an advantage for sure. Yeah. It's the likelihood of the data under the generative model that you've constructed in this optimization. So you construct a generative model which tries to assign high probability to the samples that are actually in the data set that was given to you.
That is the approximation.
It's a lower bound. So, and now I'm plotting negative log likelihood, so it's an upper bound, and we're trying to make it as small as possible. Yeah.
Right. Does it make sense to somehow not change the bound, plot the same quantity? Can you do that?
We're comparing two different upper bounds. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's right. That could be. So we try to tease this apart a little bit. Which part of this is from tightening the bound, and which part is from the model? InfoVAE was sort of our attempt to get at this, because InfoVAE tries to tighten the gap between the two different bounds. And it seems to succeed, and it seems to not make a difference. So that was our attempt to get at this. It seems like it's coming more from the noise model and less from having a slightly tighter bound. But yeah, that's something to investigate. I should speed up because I want to get to the end. So there's Fashion Eminence. This is another data set. It's a little bit harder. There's all these different shoes and bags and shirts and stuff are the images. You can see that there's, okay. You can see that this is a much harder data set. It's much harder to compress. There's a lot more information. We still do a little bit better than the other methods, even for this one. But I want to talk about rate distortion curves. So here we have sort of the compression rate, and on the y-axis we have the distortion. There's some theoretical best value that you can get for any given trade-off. That's what this line represents. Things here are feasible and things here are infeasible. But in general, if you have a lossy compression scheme, which is suboptimal, you might get some line, which is on this side. So I'll just show some examples. So these are the VAEs and other things that we compared against, their rate distortion trade-off, and we seem to get much, much better trade-offs on this plot. So that's MNIST, and this is Omniglot, and Fashion MNIST. So in all the cases, we get quite a bit stronger rate distortion trade-offs. So the task is constructing a good generative model.
Oh, it's not classification.
It's not classification, which is very strange for people who've worked on information bottleneck. It's always the supervised case. And I guess that's what I was trying to express earlier, was that the task can be anything. And this is another lossy compression task where the task is to construct a good generative model. Yeah. Yeah, sorry, so that's confusing. The most straightforward thing would have been to apply this to the supervised information bottleneck from the beginning, but we just happened to be working on this at the time. So there's some reconstructions, but it's not very interesting. When you get high compression, you see some of the differences in the reconstructions between the ECHO and the VAE model. So maybe this is an example of where more information is lost for the VAE. So I wanted to end with talking about kind of a controversy, which I know some people are interested in, to spark the discussion. The question is whether there's a connection between compression and generalization. And the reason we're talking about this is because Tishby had written a paper where he claimed that there was that this is really what explains the generalization capabilities of neural networks. And this paper had a bunch of observations that neural nets seem to do some sort of fitting, and then at the end they do kind of a compression phase. And that the compression is what's responsible for good generalization. This has been kind of controversial because it's not really clear that he's showed that this connection is, that he's really fully demonstrated this connection. So there's a lot of people who have talked about it. There's one paper that gave kind of a counterpoint where they said, well, what looks like he's seeing this compression in his paper is really an artifact of how he does the estimation of mutual information. So what looks like compression isn't really compression. And if you change the nonlinearities, you get a totally different result. So this was the kind of one of the first of several results that kind of cast a little bit of doubt on this. I'm going to skip what my reasoning is for why this compression is so hard. People at this conference worked on something similar where they said, okay, the mutual information estimation is very difficult. So let's take a specific case where we have random neural networks. In the limit of large n, then they can get analytic expressions for mutual information, and in that case, they can exploit some of these things better, and they see that there is compression that occurs, and it doesn't depend on what nonlinearity you use, but they don't really see any particular connection with generalization. So, which is all to say that the hard part of connecting compression with generalization is that we actually don't understand compression very well. It's pretty hard to tell how much compression we're doing in general. So I'm going to skip to the end because I've already gone over what Lenka wanted me to. So I'll just go to a conclusion. So it just introduced this kind of a more flexible noise model, which helps us specify our compression in a more exact way. You could use that for a lot of different things. There's a lot of things that look like lossy compression problems, and even though we haven't done that, it might be a nice way to improve this discussion about compression and generalization, where works that have come out so far have not done compression correctly, and this would help us do it. So thanks.
Who wants to start a discussion this time? Thank you for your talk. So maybe coming back on the question that I think was already asked about comparing how the Econoise Vash Null and Toe encoder is doing compared to the other kind of ways of training it. I mean, a posteriori, once you've trained your model, can't you just, switch approximations to evaluate the likelihood and see how they compare? Meaning that you will have one that you trained using the approximation of the posterior that is coming from the econoise and ones that you've trained with the, traditional approximation of the posterior that is most probably Gaussian. But can you just swap then the way you estimate the likelihood?
Oh, okay.
And see?
So that's that's a good point. Yeah,
the second one is, so we know that variational autoencoders are pretty bad at generating good-looking samples, actually. I mean, how do they look compared to the other methods,
right,
your samples?
Right. So this is a good point. So I said, okay, there's this, what I call the variational approximation between Q of Z and P of Z. And in the traditional elbow, you have P of Z. And we were saying, well, there's a specific choice, which is Q of Z. And that gives us an expression that we can calculate exactly. So in some sense, we're using the same bound. It's just that we're setting P of Z equal to something which is non-Gaussian. But maybe you're right. We could do something simple like that, which is, what if we replaced Q of Z with a Gaussian, use the same generative model, a Gaussian that has like the same moments, for instance? That's a nice idea. It would give us like a really, loosen our bound, but if we could still achieve better log likelihoods, even with this approximated prior on P of Z. Yeah, that's a great idea. I think we should try that for sure. These were some of the VAE and echo reconstructions. So you can see, so R is the mutual information or the bound of mutual information. So we have this sort of high rate regime where we do reconstructions and the low rate regime. So in the high rate regime, I don't think they're super different. There's only really subtle differences like the handle of this bag. In the high compression case, you see a few more obvious things, like these bags are quite different and these shoes get kind of mangled by the VAEs. We're trying to compare exactly the same rate. So we, you vary beta to get a different trade-off between compression and distortion. So we got kind of as close as we could. And so even though the VAE actually has more bits to work with here, it's doing a worse job of reconstruction. Yeah.
Have you tried to compare the compression that you get using econoise with those with like generalized NCAP, for instance? So train a model with SGD and then evaluate the compression using econoise and try to relate it to the gap. So this is like along the lines of Sanjeev Arora's work on compression bounds, generalized bounds.
Compare to what?
This is along the lines of Sanjeev Arora's recent work on comparing the generalization gap with that of the compression of the network, so layer-wise compression.
Oh, I see.
Of course, you said, all these analyses, the trickiest part is how do you evaluate the compression.
Right.
Perhaps using econoise is a better way of closing the gap between generalization and compression.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. That's been my impression, too, is that the empirical studies of the connection between compression and generalization have all had a hard time getting at what is the compression level. And you're saying we should compare compression in this case where we know what it is.
It's very powerful because the noise in this case comes from the data itself. It is not like an isotropic Gaussian that you put around or something that you concoct.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. We should do that. We just haven't gotten into it yet. I had one plot that was like that. So if you look at the mutual information over time, over training versus the distortion over training, this already looks kind of different than what happens in Tishby's work. He was saying that what happens is that first you do a fitting phase where the distortion goes down, but there's no compression, and then you do compression at the end. But in our case, the compression and the distortion go down at the same time, and maybe at the end, actually, the mutual information is going up. So it's pretty different than what he observed. We also have this weird transient behavior where at the beginning we sort of have no compression and then it jumps up, or a lot of compression and then it jumps up to a high mutual information and comes back down.
First part of the plot looks very weird, if I am allowed to say that.
Yeah, exactly. So we thought, oh, maybe it's just an initial condition thing. We should start with a very high rate because obviously in this part of the plot, it wants to go to a high rate and then do compression over time. But it sort of likes to go down to start kind of in a noisy regime and then do.
Thanks.
Yeah, get the signal later. Yeah.
There is a question back here as well.
Just to see if I understand, like the practical method you use for. So after you've trained this thing and you want a sample from it.
Yeah.
You go back to your data distribution and you like sample from that. You run it through that F and that S. And that defines your code variables, basically, and you put that forward through the what would be a VA. So is that a fair description?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
That was all, thanks.
Yeah, exactly. Right, you get a bunch of samples of X and calculate F of X on those, and that's how you generate samples, exactly.
So I guess what's left to your discretion is the attenuation factor, right? The form it takes, the S of X. You choose it.
Right. What
form does it take? And how does it impact, the outcome?
Yeah. So you know, we didn't think super duper hard about it. If you look at traditional VAEs, they also have a form like this: Z equals f of x plus s of x times epsilon. And what they do is they say, well, f of x should be some sort of neural network, and they say s of x should be basically take the top layer of the neural network that produced f of x, and then add a new layer which generates the S of X's. So we just did that because that way we could compare exactly the same architectures.
So it's learned.
VAE, sorry?
It has parameters that you learn during the...
Yeah, it's learned, yes, okay. That's right. So there's the neural net that does it, and we just use the exact same architectures as VAEs, so that it's apples to apples, yeah.
Some more questions that we haven't seen? Well, if not, let's thank Greg again for the talk. And just a comment for those of you who brought a poster. We will not be having a particular poster session during the conference, but there are poster boards as you are entering the court. So please put your posters and then feel free, people will feel. And for those who do not have posters, feel free to go around and try to catch the people that are presenting them somehow during the week. They will be there till Friday afternoon, when then the boards will disappear. So we will ask you to put the posters back down on Friday. And if there is not, hopefully there is enough space. There should be. Well, if not, we will add some more boards. Don't worry about it. So then let's break for lunch.